the world is run by those who show up. I almost said shut up. That's not the case. We will do anything official as people roll in. Yeah, Representative House is here. So, Commissioner Kramer, if you'd like to come and if you have a short presentation you'd like to do an overview here.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I can keep it extraordinarily brief if you'd like.
Whatever time you need.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, how much detail would you like me to go into? We have, within our budget package, we have approximately 8 separate budget items. I could touch on each one, or I could highlight just those that have policy implications.
Why don't you go over the ones with policy implications, because we're not a finance committee. Let's stick to as much of the policy as we can, and we'll let Representative Gunther sort out the rest.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, then, I'm not sure if within your package everyone has the governor's report for our department. I'm holding up a frontline copy of it here. But on page, let's flip through it here.
Page what? Well,
page 12 of our department's report, Employment and Economic Development, you'll see a program called State Funded Administration, and the change item is labeled Sale of Promotional and Marketing Materials. And Mr. Chair and members, we are bringing forward a proposal to allow the department as a whole to have the same abilities as the Minnesota Trade Office has always had. And basically this involves the ability to create material and then sell it instead of just giving it away. The Minnesota Trade Office has always had the statutory authority to create promotional materials, sell those promotional materials, and use the funds for that material to generate more material. So it's essentially ability to self-fund ourselves. In the case of the department as a whole, today we produce a great deal of material, Positively Minnesota recruitment material, Explore Minnesota recruitment material for companies and communities around the state, but we can only give it away, and if we do charge for it, any funds gained from that charge revert back to the state general fund, not to the department. And we would like to change this so that any funds gained through the sale of promotional material accrue to the department, put in a special fund that then can be used for the construction of more promotional material. Rather modest policy change, but one that has profound implications for us, because I think we'll be able to create more material and make it more widely available. To some extent, while we don't officially limit it, we tend not to give away very much material because it's self-defeating for us. It costs us more money every time we hand it out. If we're able to do this, we could charge a modest charge and then produce more material.
Excellent.
The only other thing that's from a policy perspective, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, it really isn't even that much, but it is brand new in the governor's budget. On page 9 of the governor's recommendation is a I can never pronounce this, Mr. Chair.
Methamphetamine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. cleanup fund. And this is a cleanup fund capitalized through our Public Facilities Authority that would allow us to make loans to communities for the cleanup of contaminated sites surrounding drug use. Generally speaking, cleanup is estimated, based on existing experience, to cost between $10,000 and $15,000 for the run-of-the-mill drug activity. We would make a loan to the community, and the community then would repay the loan when the site was either sold or from any fees or a restitution applied to the criminal activity. So it would be a revolving loan fund. This isn't a one-time grant. $250,000 in FY06 and $250,000 in FY07.
Excellent. Representative Sturgis.
Thanks, Chair and Commissioner. Thanks for being here today. With the dollar figure here of $250,000 in 06 and 07 to get to the $500,000, do you know what the need is out there, and is this going to get anywhere near the need that the counties and local units of government are looking for as far as funding for site cleanup?
Representative Kramer. Or Commissioner Kramer, sorry to demote you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, we've talked to the Department of Health and MPCA in estimating $250,000 approximate cleanup grant, average of $10,000. We believe there's adequate funds from $250,000 allocation to meet the demand today. Oftentimes, the cleanup goes rather rapidly because if the property is in forfeiture, the city is able to sell the property immediately or use subsequent funds, knowing that they're going to be able to sell it. This is more for distressed communities that don't have that ability. We're able to do the cleanup, and then they subsequently repay the state at a later time.
We do have quorum now, so I'll call the committee to order officially. We have the minutes in front of us. Representative Powell moves the adoption of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? the motion prevails, the minister adopted. Mr. Kramer, or do you have other comments right now? Or?
Mr. Chair, the only other comments I have from our perspective would be budget specific, and if those would be covered in Representative Gunther's committee, I'd certainly defer to that.
Okay. Questions for the commissioner? No questions? Well, Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, are we discussing this whole thing, or is he going to go through it more?
That was the extent of what we're going to specifically go through. If you have other questions, feel free to ask them. We'll just, if it gets long, we'll need to move
hopefully
along.
Hopefully it won't take long, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. House.
I'm page 40 through 42, the youth program. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, that I understand it totally, but if I go to page 42, where it goes expenditures by fund, and you have the, I believe the numbers where it's $10,700,000, I think, is that what it is, $10,700,000, that's federal money?
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, perhaps if I might ask, if you turn to page 13, there is a description of all the youth programs that are involved in our budget, and the reckoning there from the financial perspective might be easier to understand than page 42 that you're on.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, then we are... We still get federal funding, but the funding that came from the state is no longer there, disappeared.
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. The proposal is to eliminate the state funding, the Minnesota Youth Program. The federal government will continue to fund the state at approximately $10.5 million per year, not per biennium, but per year.
And the Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, could you give us the chairman or committee at a later date kind of a breakdown, pick one or two of the programs and how the total amount of money, I'll pick Youth Build for an example, what they get in federal dollars and then what they've lost in state dollars. So rather than to say we're losing or they're being eliminated $6.7 million, what is it per program? Are all programs... did they all get like an equal amount or some get a lot more than others, that kind of thing, so we get a better understanding of what these programs are now, what's now being withheld from them from the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Commissioner, do you care to comment or we'll just follow up with you later?
Mr. Chair, I'd be at your discretion. I can certainly go through them program by program or at a later date in Representative Gunther's committee, whatever you would best like.
Mr. Chairman, if you can just furnish that information to you or to Chairman Gunther, that'd be great.
If you could furnish that in writing to the committee, that would be great. By the way, for committee members, Mr. Gilday is moving to the Public Safety Finance Committee, I think it's called now. And so he'll no longer be with this committee, and I don't even know if he'll be here next week. We're scrambling to find the replacement, so...
Mr. Chairman,
I
want to
congratulate him.
Mr. Chairman, I hear that Chairman Smith has more money in his budget for more travel.
Apparently, than more money than I have. So, if you could get that, Mr. Freeman, that'd be great. Other questions? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it appears that $6 million is going to be lost in the youth programs under this budget proposal from state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. That is the proposed reduction.
Oh, that's over a third of your current budget. Oh, Mr. Chair, sorry. So that's over a third of your current budget for the youth programs, then.
Mr. Kramer.
Including the federal funding.
Yes, in fact, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's quite frankly closer to probably two-thirds. If you took the overall amount, the $10.5 million a year, remember that it's closer to a third, because 10.5, 21 million, and then our six. I'm sorry. Yeah. On a year basis, it would be larger. On the biennium, it's approximately a third.
But, Mr. Chair, final question.
Representative Goodwin.
Commissioner, then how many youth do you estimate will not be served by that program based on that cut?
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it obviously differs by program. We're talking about three separate programs here, and I should note for our members, one of the program does show up in the line item in the $6 million as a reduction, but it is not a reduction. It is a transfer. The youth intervention program today, and members served in approximately 24,318 individuals. That is simply being transferred to the Department of Public Safety. The youth intervention program targets youth with a history of interaction with the juvenile justice system. In general, it is not an economic development program. It is an intervention program to help youth reestablish any number of factors in their life and in their lifestyle more conducive to long-term interaction with society. We're therefore proposing the transfer to public safety. In the other programs, I can answer exactly. In the Minnesota Youth Program, last year, in state fiscal year 2004 that ended June 30th of 2004, we served 3,829 individuals in the Minnesota Youth Program. In the Minnesota Youth Build Program, we served approximately 250 individuals. And in the Learn to Earn, which is also proposed for elimination, and this program is not a statewide program. It is only the City of Minneapolis. It is a specific pass-through grant to the City of Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board, and they served 124 individuals last year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, too, if I might add, the total amount served between all three of these programs is just over 2% of all youth aged 16 to 21 who normally enter the labor market in any given year or summer amount. So in grand total, it's a relatively modest amount compared to all youth in Minnesota who enter the labor market either full-time or part-time, so ages 16 to 21.
Okay. Representative Clark.
This is an issue, and I'm sorry I came in late, but I'm really happy you're discussing this. I don't know if you're defending it or just telling us what happened, what will be happening. Is elimination of these programs something that you support?
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's our recommendation to the legislature via the administration at this time. As we noted in our budget pages, none of these cuts are desirable, but looking through the agency and working through the priorities we have and where we can best affect the economic success of the state, these programs do not rank as high as others. For example, cuts in state services for the blind or vocational rehab.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Okay, well, I think we're going to spend a little time on this issue. I take this very seriously. These are programs that are statewide programs, but the return on the investment is incredible. So let's just talk about a couple issues. First of all, could you tell me, Commissioner, what are the percentage of people of color in these programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first, if I could, to clarify, these are not statewide programs. There are three programs proposed for elimination. One is statewide, two are not. The Youth Build program has 10 service providers across the entire state. They are limited to specific communities, and as I noted a moment ago, they serve approximately 250 youth. The Learn to Earn program, which is also proposed for elimination, is the City of Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board only. So again, not a statewide program. And as we went through our budget recommendations, we attempted through our budget process to retain as many state programs that had statewide economic impact as possible versus those that were limited to a specific geography. For the youth program, the Minnesota Youth Program, out of 3,829 individuals, 69% are white, 719 or 19% are African American, 155 are Hispanic. By the way, Representative, all these figures are available on our website in the annual report. 353 are Asian, 229 are Native American, and 15 are Pacific Islander. So approximately 31% are people of color, 69% are white Caucasian.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark.
What is the percentage of people of color in Minnesota?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe it's actually on a per state basis, I believe it's approximately 10%. I'm not a demographer, but I believe the working number is approximately 10%.
Mr. Chairman, that could be about right. I'm not exactly sure either, but I know that the percentage of children in these programs is way above the population average of the community. So they're very much used. They're disproportionately used, three times more used in these programs. They're represented three times more than
than the actual population. In other words, they do a very good job of serving low-income people, particularly children of color. I'm also just wondering, while you may not call the Youthville program statewide, it is located throughout the state in various state agencies. One of the things that's been neat about that program is that from its very inception, it always included rural, suburban, and urban components, always, from the very beginning. It never was just urban, just suburban, and rural. It's always included all of those by design. And my question about that program, and maybe the other ones too, is what is the dollar invested by the state, what does it leverage in terms of private dollars?
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the state invests approximately $754,000 a year. There is a dollar-for-dollar match of non-state funds required. So you can infer from that, I don't have the exact amount, but a minimum of presumably $750,000 a year.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there is no federal component to this, although recently we, along with the Youth Build organizations, did compete for and win a federal $400,000 grant that applies to two of the service providers here in St. Paul and in the Arrowhead.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to take up a little time on this, but I think it's really important. These are very, very important youth programs that serve many people in our house here. It's not just one area. I mean, there are very, you can look at Youth Build. I know we have major programs in, but maybe you'd just like to run down where each of these, where the Youth Build programs are that will not be receiving these dollars anymore. Do you have those 10 statewide?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be glad to. Madam Representative, not to argue semantics, but again, for a major program, it served 250 children across the state.
Mm-hmm.
The service providers are located in Virginia, Minnesota, in Bemidji, Detroit Lakes, and I should say, actually, Detroit Lakes, it specifically says serving the city of Perham, so only the city of Perham, Stearns Benton, Kandy Ohi and Pine Counties, Carver and Scott, the city of Wabasha, and then there are two programs in St. Paul and one in Minneapolis.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner,
Representative Clark.
Commissioner, if you could, I think it might be helpful, especially to some of the new people in this committee, if you could actually bring back the information about what the state dollar leverages. I know it leverages, I think, a youthful program, and maybe you can help me, what happens in Bemidji. But we have, I think it's at least 7 or 8 times the dollar that the state invests. That's just the upfront investment. So we know that it's a very, you know, it brings a lot of dollars in the state. There's very few youth or other programs that do that in terms of what we're doing. And I guess the other thing I'd like you to report, if you could, back to the committee is, in terms of the Youth Build program, it's called Build because it helps build housing and it helps build community centers and so on. And I think 2 years ago, I'm a little rusty on this, I think maybe you could bring us this information, but the affordable housing that was built by Youth Build was a big percentage of the affordable housing built that year. So we don't just get kids trained, educated, off the streets, out of keeping them out of prisons, which again is another thing that some of the results show, which is hard to measure in dollar figures, except you can say across, I think the investment was something like $1,200, Representative Nelson, you might be able to help me remember. About $1,200, and we keep the kid out of prison. I think we're saving, $35,000, $40,000 at least now for the prison investment. So it's hard to measure all those dollars, although we could add them up. But I would ask you to come back and tell us about the affordable housing and community service building that we get from those 250 kids last year. I think that would be helpful. Dollars that, don't come out of somewhere else.
Commissioner, if you could just provide that to Mr. Freeman, and he'll distribute it to the committee, it would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. While I don't have the numbers of the private dollars that were matched against the state fund, it's important to know the program can continue without state funding. That is, at $75,000 per each of the 10 service providers, and not disagreeing at all with Representative Clark that this has been a very good program for generating private match dollars, the state's contribution per individual service provider is very modest. Again, Representative Clark, I will certainly check with MHFA on the number of units of affordable housing that were created. I can tell you that in 2003, 72 units were either constructed or worked on from renovation. And I will check and see how that number factored in compared to statewide activity in affordable housing.
Mr. Chairman, I'll end with just saying, I think for each of these programs, if we could just get from the commissioner the ones that are being discontinued state funding under your recommendation, what the public investment is from the state versus the private leveraging, what the waiting lists are. I mean, I know, and I think Representative Howells knows too, that the students who are waiting to get into these programs, lots of students. So taking away the state dollars means those lines get longer and those lives don't get supported. And so we could get that for each of those programs. And I'm not sure if there's anything else, but I think just the leveraging of the private dollar, the students that are waiting, the investment in construction, and I guess the other thing that for me is really important, I know all of these programs can bring the same information that the one program that's remaining, which is Minnesota, the YIPA program, mm-hmm. Which is also an excellent program, and I'm glad that one's not wiped out. But they all can help us understand what this upfront investment does. They've always presented charts of investment in these youth as compared to what happens if we don't invest in them and they go to prison or they have to have various kinds of other interventions, chemical dependency, anything. The investment is so significant. It's just such a big deal that I really want this committee to have a chance to hear that. We can hear from the commissioner and perhaps, Mr. Chairman, you know, at some point we probably should hear from the organizations themselves, and I don't know if you have that on the agenda at some point.
It's not on the agenda today, but it's possible. Or I might suggest that this will be all hashed out in the details in Representative Gunther's committee, and we'll be able to talk about, you know, if you have alternatives for savings, so, you know, for balancing to our budget target there. I'm sure Representative Gunther would be happy to entertain any other ideas for cost savings.
Thank you.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do apologize for opening Pandora's box, but I think it's much needed information. If the commissioner or possibly staff could look into this, in the governor's bonding proposal, I think there's $20 million for low-income housing. And if staff or you could check, is it constitutional or legal or whatever for us to put language in the bonding bill that would say a certain amount of that money could be dedicated to the youth build organizations throughout the state for materials and hours worked on low-income housing. So we could maybe fund them through the back door doing that.
I don't know if that's yours or...
staff or whoever wants to jump right in on that one.
Any volunteers?
Well, Mr. Chair, we can certainly check with MHFA on that. It's a good idea, so we'll check into that and see if it's possible through the bonding. It would be important to note, though, that, again, the youth build programs are not statewide in the sense that if the $20 million was dedicated towards a couple of particular projects, if there wasn't youth build organizations in those communities, they wouldn't be able to participate. But I understand what you're driving at.
Representative Howe.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, whenever we put language in a bonding bill, we sort of changed the direction of the administration anyway. So,
okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to make a comment with regard to the statements by Representative Clark in because of last night being at a discussion of a report from the Federal Reserve, a couple people there, my basic point to Representative Clark would, why would you expect us to do something logical like that? They were talking about ECFE and huge reports on the fact that if you put ECFE into very low-income, at-risk kids, it turns out to be extremely beneficial and cost-saving to the state in the long run, and there's national studies on that. You don't get much return from putting it into other types. So my question was, how much sense does it make right now in Minnesota, at least as of a few years ago when I checked on it, one out of every two kids in the suburbs got ECFE, one out of every 19 in Minneapolis got it. So we don't have an across-the-board thing that makes sense all the time.
Understood. We'll take that as a comment. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Kramer. just reading the narrative on this, I'm struck by how much this isn't just a summer youth employment program. This is really a targeted response to kids that the entire system is having problems with. And looking at the narrative description on page 40 and 41, it's actually addressing children who have had problems with basic skills deficiency, pregnancy, truancy, people who have been in its victim offender remediation, pre-court diversion services, et cetera. And I'm impressed, quite honestly, on page 41 with some of the outcome measures. And, for example, the percentage of participants referred for truant behavior who improved school attendance at program completion was 83% and 76%. The percentage of participants referred for illegal activities who had no further involvement with the juvenile justice system 6 months after program completion, 89%. There's other education measures. And I would just ask that we look at whether or not you've had a chance yet, Commissioner, to talk to the Education Department as well as the Department of Human Services and Corrections about spinoff effects. You know, if you discontinue this, does that put them into a different spot in the correction system and increase expenditures there? Does the school district then have to do different things related to these truants who are referred to into this program? It does look like it has some good outcome measures, but I just don't know if we discontinue this, then other parts of the system need to pick up those responsibilities.
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the items that you've highlighted are in the youth intervention program, which is not being cut at all. It's being retained at 100%.
Representative Goodwin, did you have a question? Or?
Yes, and this is an overall question. This is, I think, the fourth budget so it's not just Governor Plante's budget. It's the fourth budget that has not complied with state law as far as putting a line item in here for the cost of consultants in the agencies. So we have no idea by looking at this how much the department, your department, is spending. I know there's a separate document, but in law it's supposed to be a line item in the budget, and it has never... We've never complied with that. I'm concerned about it because as members sit around looking at this and talking about alternatives to the budget cuts that were brought up, that is a potential area where we could take money from to put into other programs. Yet we don't have that information before. So can you tell me how much in state funds your joint department now has spent in professional technical consulting contracts in the last biennium?
Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, not off the top of my head. I can tell you that it is very, very small. Most of the activity, if not all the activity, is done by our own state employees. I'm not in favor, nor do I try and go out and try and find outside consultants to do work that state employees can already do that we're paying for. But if there's a statutory requirement to have a line item somewhere in the budget that lists outside third-party fees, I'll certainly find that out for you.
I know that. It's there, and it's been there since 1998. It's in 16C. So I would look at that. And once again, I've talked to the commissioner, Dr. Peggy Ingerson, about this 2 years ago and 4 years ago, and that's still... And I'm not blaming you for that because it's the Department of Finance that's supposed to do it, but it's still not being done. And that is money that members can look at as we go through these budgets and think about what we might want to retain and what we might not want to retain based on some of those funds. So maybe you can carry that message again, but thank you.
Okay, Commissioner, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you coming. You have any... final comments, or we'll just see you in Representative Gunther's committee.
We'll see you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Next on the list is John Edmond from Explore Minnesota. Mr. Edmond, please introduce yourself for the tape, and then you can proceed with any kind of overview you'd like to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. What I'm going to do keeping with the theme of this session this afternoon, I just talk about a major change item within our budget. I won't be going through the entire budget at this time. Just for a point of reference, why I'm going to be talking about specifically a public-private enhancement funding mechanism, which is new which is a part of our proposal next year. But we previously, Explore Minnesota Tourism, were the Office of Tourism. We were within the Department of Employment and Economic Development. As of July, we became our own separate entity. A Explore Minnesota Tourism Council was created to help us grow tourism. And our budget, and I won't go into all the details, but our budget has decreased over the years, while the budgets of our competitors have had increased. So what we did with the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council is try to look at different ways we can grow tourism in the state of Minnesota. And the idea, basically, that I wanted to talk about, I believe it's on probably page 4 of the documents that I picked up here, is what's called a public-private enhancement funding mechanism. And what this basically does, it's a supplemental funding to our existing base budget for tourism, and it's available annually beginning in fiscal year 07. It's an incentive appropriation that will match private sector contributions that exceed $4 million, and up to half of that amount can be in kind. And this incentive is capped at $1 million a year. Very, very basically, what this does is it says that in the first year of the biennium, Explore Minnesota Tourism has to get increased participation from the private sector. We have to generate at least $4 million cash or in kind. Then for every dollar that we generate above and beyond that $4 million, we can generate an additional dollar from the general fund, again, it's capped at $1 million. It's a way for us to work in partnership with the private sector to leverage the dollars that we're getting from the state, and also to focus our efforts to make sure we're generating the most we can from the private sector. This is part of a long-term strategy to grow tourism with reduced dependence on general funds. And it's also something that was industry-driven. It was supported by our Tourism Council. We had listening sessions all throughout the state of Minnesota and looked at different ways to grow tourism. And this was the current mechanism that came to the top where there was the most support. And what it does, it rewards innovative partnerships and increases the private sector's involvement in our state tourism. This basically provides an opportunity to increase our annual budget for marketing. Match, as we define it, is basically revenue to the state or documented cash expenditures directly to support our efforts. And currently, we're actually doing some of this right now in developing public-private partnerships. We monitor this and report it on an annual basis. We develop agreements with partners, and then we provide reports on the value of these partnerships to ensure that we reach our goals. And we did, through our listening sessions and our Tourism Council, we talked about a variety of different other alternative funding mechanisms. We looked at things like just gaming revenues, lodging tax, performance-based funding, rental car fees, etc. But right now, there wasn't the level of industry support for those alternatives beyond this public-private partnership approach. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but in conclusion, this is just the first step. We're a new organization, a new public-private organization, and this is a one funding mechanism that rewards partnerships and leverages our state investment in Minnesota tourism. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. Representative Gunther, you have a question?
Thank you. Mr. Redman, basically what you're looking at then is you're looking at outcome-based funding, or kind of the Missouri model. Is that correct?
Mr. Redman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, yes, it is outcome-based in the sense that we'll focus our agency and we'll focus all of our staff's efforts to look at what are we generating from the private sector. So we'll have to basically, on a monthly or quarterly basis, look at the dollars that we're bringing in through all our programs, because that will guide us for the state to make an additional investment. It's not just us going to you and saying we want more money because we're more important than all the other things that you just talked about. We're willing to say that we're willing to generate additional dollars from the private sector. We'll be matching our performance or our revenue to how we perform. The Missouri model is a little different. That's a mechanism that's kind of automatic, that's set up based on revenue from sales tax revenue from SIC codes. From the tourism industry, and it's basically set up so if you hit sales tax numbers, boom, you automatically get the increase. That could be or could not be as a result of what the state is doing. This is directly related to what we're doing. We have to perform it in order to get the revenue back.
Thank you. Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, when you said that the Tourism Council supported this, what did the small resort
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the way that we came up with this was actually started before the Tourism Council, and we had listening sessions throughout the state. The Explore Minnesota Tourism Council is made up of representatives of the Congress of Minnesota Resort, the Minnesota Resort Association, as well as hotel and motel groups. And this was unanimously supported by this group. As I mentioned, there was other concepts we talked about, and some of them were controversial. There wasn't consensus on some of these other alternative funding mechanisms. The resort industry in particular feels that they're an industry or segment of our industry that is going through a lot of changes. We're losing the number of resorts. They feel the state needs to do more to market tourism in our state because of the return on investment. And this type of mechanism is the one that there was just the most unanimous support of everything that we talked about. So, yeah, I would be willing to say, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the resort industry is behind this proposal.
Any further questions? Representative Surge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you failed to mention you have two very handsome state representatives that sit on that council as well, Representative Simpson and myself. here's a question that kind of comes out of, I missed the second meeting as Representative Simpson did. We were down here working when they had the second Tourism Council meeting of this year. I know during the first meeting, the council actually talked about an increase in funding for tourism. With this $1 million base cut that I see in here, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we kind of walk a fine line here between policy and funding, and so I'll ask it anyways. When you take away the $1 million, I know we're setting up this new public-private enhancement, but in the discussions we had in there, where's the incentive to go out there and do more as public and private? For me, policy-wise, I would think if we're looking at increased funding to tourism as the resort owners and those organizations were asking for that time, would it not be better for the state to enhance this funding, not reduce it by $1 million, to see if the public sector or the private sector could go out there and raise more money to match with? And that's kind of, I thought, the discussion we had the first meeting, and I'd just like your comments on that.
Mr. Edmund.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, the industry would like to see increased funding for tourism. There's no question about that. When you look at our budget compared to our neighboring states, we're lower than Missouri, we're lower than Wisconsin, we're lower than Illinois or Michigan. So the industry really feels that we need to do something. This public-private enhancement fund, I'm actually very pleased to have this in the budget, because without it, frankly, we probably would be taking cuts. When you all as legislators are looking at other higher priorities, I believe in the concept of return on investment. I believe the dollars that we spend on tourism bring dollars back to our economy. But you have to deal with some very tough decisions in terms of other priorities when you have limited revenue. So we're looking at the public-private enhancement fund as a way to kind of offset some of the other reductions. If you look at, and I know we're probably getting into some of the funding issues that we'll talk about in Representative Gunther's committee, but if you look at our overall budget, right now we begin the biennium at about $16 million. We have a base budget cut of $2 million. The enhancement fee goes back in as an increase and added back to that of $1 million. And then we also have a transfer from deed for administrative costs of about $1.1 million. And so you add all that up, we're pretty much at the same level that we were before. Some of that goes to fixed costs, etc., so it's not perfect. But the enhancement fund is just as a way to try to leverage dollars in a different way, given these times. Yes, we would have liked to have that dollar amount more, but it's at least an important first step for us at Explore Minnesota Tourism to look at different ways to grow tourism. We'd like to see that also replaced later on. In fact, we're going to have some listening sessions all throughout Minnesota over the next 6 months, and I hope you as council members will also participate, where we're going to ask the industry for alternative ways, maybe with less dependence on general fund. Or maybe that's the answer, general fund, I don't know. So we need to look at alternative funding mechanisms. This is just, it's actually modest, but it is a first step in a new direction.
Other questions? Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I just want to answer the question that I asked the commissioner earlier, and that is that the Department of Employment and Economic Development spent $42.5 million in contracts this biennium, and actually only $8 million two bienniums before that. So there's a significant three, four times increase in the amount they spent in this biennium. Now, of that, about $10-12 million was state funds, and the rest was, most of the rest was federal funds.
Do you have information on what the nature of those contracts were? Or?
No, this is all the information that I would appreciate getting that information from the department.
Let's look. We'll work on that. Representative Rukavina.
Your figures on page 6-5 of your handout here, where you talk about every dollar invested in tourism provides a return of $460 in state and local tax, $240 in wages, $53 in gold sales. Kind of a formula they use to provide it.
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that's done by some return on investment studies that we do. What we do is that we basically maintain the list of people that contact Explore Minnesota Tourism for information. We go back and survey those people and ask them, did you receive that information? Did you contact as a result of our advertising? If they said yes, then we ask them, did you take a trip? As a result of receiving that information. You ask them then how much did you spend, what portion of that trip went into taxes, and then you compare the dollar amount that you spent on advertising to contact those people based on what they told you is how much they spent, and that's how you get the basic return on investment figures.
So it's an actual survey of some type, not a formula like we've seen on here where we use a multiplier or something like that, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, yeah, we actually go out and survey thousands of consumers that contact us every year and provide these return on investment studies. I'd be happy, Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, to give you a complete copy of that report, which will show the whole methodology and how we came up with that information. We used to, Representative, have actually a figure that was about a 10-to-1 figure, 9-to-1 figure, but that also factored in the federal tax contributions. And so we took that out of the equation. So that's why it's actually gone down a little bit to 5-to-1. But if you factor in the federal tax contributions, it would even be higher.
Yeah. That's it. I think, Mr. Edmund, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next is the Board of Architecture, James O'Brien and Doreen Frost. You please introduce yourselves for the tape and proceed with any prepared comments you have.
Good afternoon. I'm Doreen Johnson Frost. I'm the Executive Director at the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. And sitting to my left is our board chair.
I'm Jim O'Brien. I'm an architect member of the board, the same board. I won't go through the list. And I'm currently the chair of the board.
How do you fit that on your business card, that the name of the organization?
I leave my name off.
Go ahead.
Is the committee familiar enough with the activities of our board and the makeup of our board, or would you like a summary of that? Or
you know, if you could give just a few minutes summary, that would probably be a good idea. We have a lot of new people on the committee.
Okay. The sole purpose for the board, it regulates 7 professions, and the sole purpose is the protection of the health, the welfare, and the safety of the public. And we do that through a licensing process that sets standards for competence, accountability, and ethics. And that is based on measurable objective criteria, education, examination, and experience. The mission is accomplished by administration of the licensing process, updating the Minnesota rules, working with the legislature to make sure that our statutes and rules are keeping pace with technology and changing in practice, and enforcing our statutes and rules. The board is unique in that it does regulate 7 design professions. Most states have separate boards for each profession. Minnesota has a combined board. Some boards will license 2, maybe 3, but other than Minnesota, there is not a design licensing board that deals with as many professions. That has obvious financial benefits to the state, of course, because it's one executive secretary and one group of very dedicated staff members. The professions have relatively well-defined practice areas. Architects deal with the art and science of construction and the planning, design, and construction supervision. They really deal with how a building will function, its exit and safety, life safety requirements, and they usually coordinate the work of other design professionals involved in the building process. Engineers deal with structural, mechanical, electrical, and communication systems for building and structures. They also, of course, do dams, bridges, highways, airport runways, that type of thing. And when the laws were for this board were enabled, the engineering profession was a shadow of what it is today, because today the engineers are also involved in designing pacemakers, medical monitoring equipment that hospitals use, pollution control and monitoring systems, computers and software, that type of thing. All of those theoretically are regulated by our board. Land surveyors locate property boundaries, topographic and boundary maps. They deal with natural features, site features, design and select land parcels, and construction projects for layout work. Landscape architects deal with the exterior surroundings of the buildings. They also coordinate construction. They're concerned with site drainage and parking and vehicular circulation, that type of thing. The geoscience aspect of our board deals with two professions, geologists and soil scientists. They deal with earth sciences, environmental issues and cleanups, protection of water supplies, natural resource conservation, as well as soil testing and monitoring of soil conditions during construction of structures. Certified interior designers. The other professions are licensed. Interior designers are certified, which means that someone cannot call themselves a certified interior. It's a title act rather than a practice act, but their profession is regulated by our board also. And they're concerned with the design and furnishing of interior spaces. We have 21 board members, four of which are public members, and a very capable but small staff of professional and clerical members. We currently license about 15,000 professionals and certify, examine and process approximately 800 applications for licensure and certification per year, and we typically receive in excess of 100 complaints about the activities of the professions that we license, and our enforcement capability deals with that. And with that, any questions related to the budget, Ms. Frost will be much more capable of handling than I will.
And Ms. Frost, would you care to just make any comments on changes?
Well, the change order that is really before this agency actually combines the Board of Accountancy and this board as two standalone boards in June of 06. It has to do with a combination of administrative issues rather than an actual budget line item for this specific agency. The Board of Accountancy and the Board of Accountancy chair is also in the audience today. But our budget has not been increased or decreased. However, the change item that would be impacting our agency would be a combination of the administration of the two boards.
Okay. Any comments or questions? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had people tell me that they have contacted your office with complaints on a number of the different licensees that you oversee, and they don't know what your process is because they don't feel like their complaints have been taken seriously or that they have received any feedback or information about what you've done about it. And 103 complaints sounds awfully low for an entire year. My question is, what do you do when a complaint comes in, and what are the repercussions for somebody that, let's say, does the soil surveying and doesn't find what they need to find, and somebody gets a house built and it gets full of mold and that type of thing. We have a lot of issues about mold going on in the state now, and a lot of it is blamed on either the architectural design, the construction, or the soil surveillance. So what is your response to people when they call your office?
Typically,
Mr. O'Brien,
we have a complaint committee that deals with the enforcement. And the deliberations of the complaint committee are protected by the Data Practices Act. So it cannot be discussed outside the complaint committee. The rest of the board members don't even take part in any of those discussions or hear about the result. And the complaint committee will make a recommendation after reviewing and investigating the complaint. will make a recommendation for some kind of action to the board, either a cease and desist order or some other type of device. But,
Ms. Frost.
Representative Goodwin and Chair, we do get homeowners that call often. Homes are exempt under our licensing law. Under Minnesota Statutes 326.02 through 326.15, this board deals with no homesteads. They are resident, individual residences are exempt from requiring licensing laws. So for any of complaints where a single family resident, an owner, homeowner calls our office, we lack jurisdiction for that matter. We have no ability. So I think we're talking about two different sets of numbers. One is the number of citizens that call our state as a regulatory agency, particularly homeowners dealing with single-family resident issues, soils, that sort of thing. Unless it's a licensed land surveyor or a licensed architect that actually did the work, we have zero jurisdiction over those people. Typically, we get more calls that are related to contractors, and they are referred to the Department of Commerce, who has jurisdiction over that group. So single-family residences are not under our licensing law.
Is it, Mr. Pender, is that all under Commerce, or is there some under admin?
Some under Health.
And Health. Or do you know?
Mr. Chair, I don't know.
Okay. Someone get that down in the minutes. I'm kind of proud of that. I stumped him. Representative Goodwin, do you have another question?
No. I was just going to say that admin and commerce share responsibility for the building codes, and Department of Health licenses plumbers and so forth. The Department of Labor and Industry licenses some construction types, boilermakers and some others. So that's an interesting thing for someday.
Take
a look at all of this.
We'll open up that
places.
Can of worms at another time. Any further questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Rukavina.
Chair. Yes. For either one of you, when you combine with the Board of Accountants, are you eliminating the one administrative position? You and is there any significant change in the budget?
Ms. Frost.
Sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative, the Board of Accountancy's Executive Director, who's in the audience, will be retiring on August 1st of 2005. Excuse me, April 1st of 2005. He's more eager than I am to have him leave. And that budget has been reduced by his salary as well as benefits, and I believe that percentage is approximately 16%. Their staff, which is also very small, will not be reduced in actual staff. Both of our agencies are small, and they will be combined. Our physical space, staff space is in one building, and that space will have to be combined.
Chair, Representative Poppin has got it by 5 up, but congratulations. I just hope that they're not reducing your salary, and I hope he wasn't getting murdered.
Sir, he was, but that's a different issue.
Any further
questions?
Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate your time. Final one is the Board of Electricity, Mr. John Schultz. And members, just noticed in my packet, I want to bring it to your attention. I can't remember, maybe Representative Sturdivant had some questions earlier when we had the overview for Commerce on long-term care and increases in the rates. Commerce was doing a white paper on that. We now have it. And products in your packets, and kind of explains what's going on in the market that caused increases in rates, and that'll answer all your questions in that area. So just take that with you for nighttime reading. Okay, Mr. Schultz, would you like to proceed, or whoever's going to proceed here, just please introduce yourself for the tape.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Schultz. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Board of Electricity. And to my right is John Williamson, who is the Assistant Executive Secretary, and to Mr. Williamson's right is Gary Nolbach, who is the Board President and is an electrical contractor member of the Board. Each of you are receiving a handout that I prepared to give you some background information on the Board's concerns regarding the governor's recommendation that there be a one-time transfer of $4 million from the board's inspection escrow account to the state's general fund. Would the committee like to have just a brief overview of the board's activities?
Brief, yes.
Very brief.
That'd be great.
The Board of Electricity is, forget the pun, but charged with licensing individuals and businesses that perform electrical work, as well as inspecting installations that are performed by those entities. The board is, by default, the inspection authority in all areas of the state that haven't adopted a local inspection ordinance. There are 40 such political subdivisions that have adopted a local inspection ordinance. The board is the inspection, or the licensing authority, I should say, in all areas of the state. About 67% of the population then is under the inspection authority of the state, or of the board. The board annually makes approximately 170,000, or inspects about 170,000 separate inspections or jobs. It results in about, based on an average of about two inspection trips or two plus inspection trips per job, somewhat over 350,000 separate trips, results in about 1,600 inspections performed every day. The board does not use employees to perform those inspections. Rather, it uses individuals under professional technical contracts that actually make those inspections. The board compensates under those contracts based on a percentage of work of the inspection fee of each job that's inspected. The current percentage breakdown, about 87% of the inspection fee is used then to offset the direct inspection cost, and about 13% then is transferred to the board's general operating accounts to offset other inspection expenses, processing, employee expense, etc. The board is specifically concerned about the governor's proposal, and I did prepare a written statement regarding that, and I just want to go over some of the highlights of that. The board believes that the governor's recommendation was not based on a full, complete understanding of the board's inspection escrow account. The board operates in a special revenue fund, doesn't receive any funding from the state's general fund, and again is totally funded through licensing and inspection fees or related activities. The dedicated or escrow account is just that. It operates as a true escrow account. The fees that are paid by contractors and installers are paid prior to them beginning the work. Those monies then are received by the Board of Electricity, deposited in a dedicated account set up by the Department of Finance. Those monies for individual inspections are tracked separately. At any one time, there may be anywhere from 85,000 to 110,000 of these open jobs in existence at one time. The board's activities are obviously subject to legislative audit. The board's inspection escrow account was last audited by the legislative auditor in 2003. The effect of the governor's proposal would be to, in effect, take the funding away from about 80,000 inspections that have already been paid for. That is almost one half of 1 year's total number of inspections or jobs that are inspected. It would take those monies away from those and then would require other jobs or the funding or the inspection fees for other jobs, future jobs, then to pay for those inspections that the funding had been removed from. We believe, creates some significant risk because that model only works in a steady or expanding business climate. It doesn't work if you have a any type of a reduction over any particular period of time. Reducing or providing that $4 million reduction, that permanent reduction, in effect causes then the board's escrow account to operate in a permanent $4 million deficit. The accounting would still have to take place on each job to ensure that the monies were distributed properly for particular inspection fees for particular jobs. The board also recognizes that it appears that the figures used by the Department of Finance and the governor were end of calendar year 2004, where the inspection escrow account was $5.2 million. That is typically or traditionally the highest value throughout the year. The value in that escrow account will vary seasonally, and actually it generally is at its lowest point in April or May, and this past April was actually at $4.63 million. Taking the $4 million off then obviously results in only about $630,000 in that account. The board typically then has an expense towards that account of in that $600,000 to $700,000 range per month. So that really puts that particular escrow account in significant risk. There's real concern on the part of the board that its funding model, which has served the industry quite well, has served the citizens of the state quite well, in which there's a direct payment for a direct service. There's very minimal associated costs, administrative costs, etc. It's a funding model that works very well. It doesn't recognize if the governor's recommendation came to pass that there would be any benefit for contractors or other installers, or for that matter, the citizens of the state or those people that need to have their particular projects inspected. And for that reason, the board would request that the governor's recommendation be not approved.
Mr. Schultz, is there any inspections that won't happen because of the governor's recommendation, or will it just the cash flow be different?
Well, the cash flow, Mr. Chairman, the cash flow may offset those expenses, but that's only if the construction activity is maintained and increases over time. Historically, there's been some increases. There's also been some decreases. The current construction activity has been significantly buoyed by the large amount of housing that has been constructed over the last few years. There's a question in the industry as to how long that will maintain itself. And I can't answer that. It's, even the experts aren't able to come up with any predictions on that.
Okay, so I think my answer was they will continue to happen. It just depends on the change in the level of activity may or may not affect whether you go into like an overdraft type situation.
Mr. Chairman, that's true. However, there the other factor that must be considered is the percentage of the inspection fees that the board must pay to attract inspectors. Even though the percentage, overall percentage today is about 87%, it may, as we move through our fee cycle, which is a fixed fee. It's not based on valuation, so it doesn't automatically adjust for inflation. We will have to adjust some of the contract percentages to have the net our net earnings as such off of inspections reduced. So yeah, there is a risk there also.
Representative Foles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schultz, could you could you explain or describe to the committee how the board's fund balance, the escrow balance, got to the $5.2 million range? I mean, has it built up over time, last 5 years, 10 years?
Mr. Schultz, Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the $5.2 million that was in the escrow account at the end of this calendar year actually represents 104,000 jobs that are in progress. Obviously, the inspections are done throughout the progress of the job, but they are not completed until the job is completed. So that actually represents inspections that have been filed for, permits that have been taken out, but wherein the inspection process or inspection activity is still in process. And then upon completion, those monies will be paid. Obviously, every day we're getting more permits in, we're closing out other ones. It's an ongoing process. The $5.2 million is you might say that's somewhat of an average balance that we will have. That average balance in that escrow account may vary anywhere from $4 to $5 million throughout the year, but it is the average balance of open work.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, just so I understand, Mr. Schultz, has that been fairly consistent then over the last 5-10 years, that $4 to $5 million balance in your escrow account?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coles, if you look at the summary financial report, I believe it's the buff-colored document that you have there, and if you look at the last page of that document, that will identify the board's inspections escrow account. On the left-hand column under revenue, you've got inspection fees. As you carry that across, you will see that is the total amount of inspection revenue or fees that have been received per fiscal year. You'll see that in 2000 it was $6,142,382, increased in 01. One of the significant factors in the increase between 2000 and 2001 and actually into 2002 was the adjustment in the inspection fees that occurred beginning July 1 of 2000. But it is held steady in effect over time, not increasing dramatically in the last few years. However, the board's enforcement activities has increased somewhat, so that we've increased revenue from that standpoint. It's really just a snapshot in time. Those revenues, if you compare back 10 years, of course, it was prior to the fee adjustment. There was, based on a couple of factors. Number one, the fee adjustment, the increase in some of the types of structures, the combination of the two has increased that overall figure. I think it was compared to back to 10 years. Well, 10 years is not comparing oranges or apples to apples, it's comparing oranges to apples.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and guests. I'm not unsympathetic to your plight here, but I wonder if you keep calling this an escrow account. And from what I understand, escrow account is where the person is paying in the money actually retains title to that for some period of time while it's in the account until it's paid out. And just to be clear, that's not what you mean here, right? The person who's paying the fee doesn't retain title to that money once it's paid. Am I correct there?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, that's true in one respect and not in another. For example, the law requires that the installer, the wiring, the contractor, that they file the permit or the request for electrical inspection as well as the fee at or before the commencement of work. In some instances, the work will not be done by that particular contractor. That contractor then is issued a refund. In all instances, the fees submitted are audited. If it is found that the contractor has overpaid, they are issued a refund. So it's to some, or at least to a significant degree, those, I think what's critical is that the fee for a particular inspection is tied and tracked until that, for that particular inspection, until that that inspection is completely resolved. So in that regard, it is more like a true escrow account. It doesn't just simply go into a fund where it's not tracked by that separate account as such. So it is more like a true escrow account than not.
Oh, well, Mr.
Representative Chair.
Yeah, that being the case, is there a legal issue in tapping this money just to go into the general fund? That's one part of my question. And the other part, maybe more in the nature of a comment, is if we then take this fund and just turn it over into the general fund, isn't that one more instance that something being called a fee and in fact turning out to be a tax because it then supports the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I'm glad that you are recognizing that issue. I know that, for example, if the legislative audit had uncovered or discovered that the board had been using those funds for other purposes, that would have been identified in big bold letters. The current law does require it to be those funds to be deposited in a special revenue fund. There is a special account set up by the Department of Finance for those funds to be deposited in. They're tracked separately. It is not until after the inspections are completed that then there is transfer of those funds or the remaining funds to the board's other operating account.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you done? This is truly a comment. I appreciate Mr. Schultz being with us here today. To your original question and your previous capacity, are you still doing the Legislative Audit Commission?
Yep.
We've had those nice folks come before this committee and others that I've served on, and I suspect that they'd be rolling around if we tried to do this, or if the agency itself tried to do this. The legislative auditor would have been, I suppose the kind term would have been that it was financial gymnastics. I mean, it'd be completely inappropriate for this agency to take those funds that have been set aside for those jobs and use them for any other purpose. While I have considerable respect for what the governor is trying to do and the contortions that he's had to try to work in order to make the budget work and keep his pledge at the same time, this one is very much a slippery slope. And I think we need to ask ourselves, what would the legislative auditor think? What would an auditor think if we were doing this with our own monies? Monies that had been allocated for one thing, then we went and raided them for another. I compare it even unfavorably to what we have in the Social Security system. But as we know, that's doing just wonderfully right now. We've got a situation where we've got obligations, ongoing obligations, and now we're going to pay them with a future generation. While I have great respect for what the governor's endeavoring to do here, this one starts a very slippery slope. And I think if we do this, we probably open ourselves up for all kinds of issues down the road. We probably open ourselves up for all kinds of issues down the road that we may not want to have a part of.
I can tell you that if the agency did that, the auditor probably would have some issues. If the legislature did it by statute, there'd be no issue with the legislative auditor.
With the legislative auditor.
But we look forward to the alternatives that are brought forward by Representative Atkins
to find
other savings. Representative Foles.
I just have one more follow-up. I'm just trying to... I understand what's going on here, and I'm like Representative Levin said, I'm sympathetic to what you're coming forward with, but I'm trying to understand this sheet here. There's a line item, BOE inspection earnings. Can you tell me what that is? Can you help me understand this document better?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pauls, the Accounting Code 4573, in effect, is the accounting code into which the approximate 13% of that inspection fee, the residual after the direct inspection costs are paid, that are then go into the board's general operating accounts to pay for board salaries, other administrative costs, other expenses associated with administering the inspection program. So this summary financial report was intended to be a report that would be fairly easily understood by the general population, et cetera, so that it provided it's almost a self-explanatory overview.
Representative Poulsen?
Well, in that case, I guess I'm sorry for asking so many questions. Can you describe what, if any, steps have been taken by the board over the last couple of years? You mentioned that 13% to cover administrative costs at the board. Have there been any steps taken to try to generate some efficiencies at the board at the administrative level, and have there been any administrative reductions over the past few years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, we always strive to, you know, to be more efficient. In fact, the number of employees that within the core office that actually do the back room work for that are related to inspections has actually been reduced. We've used those some of those FTEs then in other areas where we've had other growth. For example, the other side of our business, which is the licensing side, where we've actually doubled the number of license holders over the last 2 years. Even though we have increased our FTEs, we've actually transferred people from the inspection side over to the licensing side to meet the demand there. We've shifted people around. We've reassigned people. We actually have the same or lesser number of people that are processing the incoming requests for inspections today than we did 5 years ago. And, you know, that's, again, you say, well, how do you do that? Well, in some instances, you make sure that you match people's skills with jobs, and that's what we've done. There isn't a lot of room for greater efficiency. We do look forward in the future to be able to have a lot of our requests for inspections filed online. We aren't there yet. Again, that's an issue that we started working with the Department of Intertech, I guess, is what it was called at that time, a number of years ago, and actually started that twice, and there hasn't come anything of it as of yet. But it is something that, again, as a self-funded agency, we have to save our money so that we can spend rather than spend and look for resources later. So we have the money in hand before we actually spend it.
Representative Holt.
Mr. Rose, I'll be as direct as I can. 5 years ago, administrative costs were X, today they're Y. Has that gone up, down, stayed the same as a percent of your budget, or however you want to give that number to me?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, if you look at the second page of the summary financial report, this is the expenditure page, and it's going to identify that our costs over time have actually remained fairly constant, you know, 2000, 2001, et cetera. If you look at that total line that is about two-thirds or three-fourths of the way down the page, you'll see that it has been fairly constant over the time. Now, that I think that indicates that, yes, we have maintained costs as to a minimum over time, even while our other business activity has increased dramatically.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Representative Goodwin.
One quick comment. Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm sorry, didn't catch your name.
Mr. Schultz.
You have very few inspectors in certain areas of the state. I know in Pine County we had to wait a significant amount of time to get an inspector to inspect the electricity at our cabin, and what we heard was that he was the only one that did it for, I don't know if it was just in all of Pine County or whatever, but we had over this last summer. So how would this cut affect the ability of you to have enough inspectors or to get more inspectors so that people aren't waiting so long to have their inspections completed? Or, and is that a problem, I guess, is my main question. Is that a problem, or was it just an anomaly that happened, or is that something that you don't have, an issue that you don't have enough inspectors now to cover the territory that they have to cover?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The board currently has approximately 90 individuals under contract to provide inspection service in the areas that the board inspects. Those contracts have to be viable, meaning that there has to be enough potential compensation to attract a provider. We have inspection areas that are as small as one township, for those of you in the rural area to relate to, in another areas or as small as one city. In other instances, there are multiple counties, but it's based on obviously the type of, or the amount of activity that's there. We also adjust the compensation percentage. The compensation percentage currently varies from 75% in the most densely populated areas to 150% in the least populated areas. We pride ourselves in providing the most timely service that we possibly can. In the majority of the inspections are done within the same day that they're scheduled. They're scheduled in the morning, they're done that same day. When you get out to the less populated areas, the inspector may only be in a particular area maybe three times a week. In other instances, in very rare instances, it may be only once a week in some of the very remote areas. It's always important, and just as a point of information, if you have a concern regarding inspection service, the best place to start is at the top, and that's with contacting either me directly or Mr. Williamson, who's actually the director of inspections, and those inspections will be done in a very reasonable, timely manner.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schultz. Gentlemen, we got one more question. Yeah. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schultz, basically, this is a government entity that has netted over about $2 million over the course of 5 years. The way that I understand this inspections escrow account, or operations escrow, is it time that we reduce the inspection fees?
Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, actually the pressure from the industry and from the inspection community is to increase the fees. Our fees, again, as I indicated, don't automatically compensate or adjust for inflation. They are fixed based on size of service, number of circuits, type of installation, etc. So they don't automatically adjust over time. They were last adjusted in 2000. We anticipate seeking an adjustment for the 2008-2009 budget cycle, and at that time would look for a modest increase. Again, you mentioned the percentage on the contracts that we pay for the inspection service. After the 2000 adjustment to the fees, we actually reduced the percentages for a number of the contracts from 80% to 75%, and others also about 5%. Some of them we left the same, obviously, because of the significant problems that we have in certain areas attracting quality inspectors. But it runs a cycle. If you look at the budgets or the financial report summary on page 2, where on the bottom where it says board operations total, you'll see that that's a summary of the operating revenue, the expenditures, and the net at the bottom is actually the amount of money at the end of the fiscal year that is in effect carried forward. And you'll see that in 2000 it was 368,000, 2001 dropped to 97, came up to 167, and you'll see a significant jump to 617 and subsequently to 729. Those the jump from 2002 to 2003 and subsequently 2004 were directly related to the extreme licensing activity in that same time frame, where we increased our license, our personal license holders by 10,500, almost doubled our license holder base. So those related to increased in, application exam fees and that's where and license fees. So that's where that jump came from. We will see that level off, plateau, and then go back down the other way over time, which is a common cycle that we experience.
Okay, Representative Simpson?
Just one quick question. Are your staff people that are out in the field, are they salaried, or are they paid on a per-circuit, per-stop basis?
Mr. Schultz. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the contract inspectors are professional. They're under professional technical contracts. They are paid a percentage of the inspection fees on the jobs that they complete. It's basically piecework that they're paid under. The board has currently 28 FTEs on staff that are currently filled. The rest, the 90 inspectors are under contract, under professional technical contract. They are not employees of the board. They are independent contractors.
So they would certainly encourage an increase in the fee then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, there's always that concern.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Schultz, on the revenue funds, I mean, to take away a one-time $4 million balance, it has to cost us as taxpayers, as somebody, a significant amount of interest earnings that otherwise would have been generated on an ongoing basis. And that's another price of that one-time shift. Who earns those interest earnings right now? Does that go to the general fund? It goes back into the revenue fund? What's the trade-off on the ongoing revenue source for that interest?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I appreciate you bringing that issue up. The Board of Electricity does not receive any return on investment of its average daily balance of over $5 million. That money goes directly into the general fund. In fact, the electrical industry would actually desire that the interest, in fact, earned off of primarily off of the escrowed fees, actually at least a portion of that be dedicated back to the Board of Electricity to offset other expenses, improvements, etc.
There's a very long line for that money, Mr. Schultz. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schultz. I have this document here from the Department of Finance, and it shows that your department had a $16.8 million professional technical contracts. How many inspectors do you get for that kind of money? I don't see that in your budget analysis here. I see different little pots where you've got it, where you've got the professional technical contracts. But $16.8 million, and projected to go to 18 over $18 million for the upcoming biennium, and I just want to know how many inspectors you get for that money and if it's more beneficial to do it through contracts or through employees.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this committee is asking some very good questions. They're bringing out some very good points. There are currently approximately 90 individuals under contract. The figure that you're looking at is for a biennium. An interesting point is that the state of Washington, to which Minnesota is compared to many times, has an electrical licensing and inspection program that is somewhat similar in volume to what Minnesota's is. The difference is that the state of Washington uses employed inspectors. Their total cost of operation, first off, they have 250 FTEs that operate. If you included the 90 contract inspectors and the 30 FTEs, that's 120, that's less than half of what their total FTEs are. So in effect, it would, even if you look at the total budget and you put some average dollars onto the salaries and the like, you're going to come up with it being costing the state of Washington about over 1.5 times what it does Minnesota for the same amount of service.
Representative Goodwin?
Do you know what the state of Washington pays? Or are you projecting that based on your expenses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I know that they have 250 employees mm-hmm. that administer a program that is very similar in volume to what Minnesota's is. Again, if you look at what the average salaries would be for most of them would be inspectors and make the same comparison, you're going to see that the costs would work out to be about 1.5 times what the costs are for the same amount of work, the same amount of service that Minnesota provides.
Thank you.
I think that's it. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Schultz. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Novak, the board president, would like to make just a brief comment.
Sure. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Gary Novak. I own Industrial Electric in Minneapolis, and as an electrical contractor, the State Board of Electricity provides a very vital service to us as contractors for licensing and inspection. In viewing this, we feel this is not good policy, and we're very concerned what would happen if there was an economic downturn and we could not get the money that we've paid in for inspections and have that service performed for us. If the state got into real hard times, we would really be compromising the safety for the citizens of Minnesota. So we're very concerned about this and would recommend not doing this.
Yep. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. I think that's it, and we're running out of time, so thank you, and we are adjourned.